Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm pleased to have as my guest for the first time a writer I've wanted to talk to for quite a while. It's Pete Dexter, and his new novel is Train. It's published by his new publisher, Doubleday. He's the author, in order, of God's Pocket, Deadwood, Paris Trout, Brotherly Love, and The Paper Boy, all novels, all available at one point or another, probably still in paperback. The new novel is Train. Now, I remember a book that I was reading by Jim Thompson. A criminal had come home to his mother. He lifts her up in the air, and she's so frightened to see him that she urinates. And there's a certain kind of world, you know, that noir world, in which even blood ties are in some way violated. Something of this kind happens in Train. A woman realizes that she's urinated to protect herself. And I wanted to begin by asking you to describe that kind of a world.
Well, I guess what I'd say to that is the world's always struck me as a very fragile place, and that you go around taking things for granted a lot. I mean, the way things are, you forget the nature of change and the nature of chance, and that, you know, when you're suddenly confronted with that, it can be it doesn't have to be as part of a boat hijacking as it is in this book, but you're confronted with what is, with that other thing out there, you can have strange reactions to it. I mean, things break more easily than you ever would think they would.
Now, these characters very easily might not have met. What brought them into the same book for you?
I kind of follow things. I don't lead them, and it just occurred.
Because when I was reading this one, it seemed to me, you know, Faulkner's novel, Wild Palms?
He
has two
it.
Separate books, and they're alternate chapters, two completely separate sets of characters, two completely separate stories, and in fact, they never come together. He calls it a novel. And you don't know as a reader, you know, if you're not, you know, like being overexposed to things and things are spoiled for you by some teacher, you don't know that these guys aren't going to come together. You think, of course, it's a novel, they must. But there's this funny feeling in Train. The chapters alternate, you're in different places, and you don't quite know how these characters are going to link up, or even at times if they will. Their passing through each other's lives seems very coincidental.
Well, yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, I think it is coincidence, and I think the looks, you know, at first it's just glimpses, but they do, I mean, it's almost like glimpsing each other out, you know, through a window. But then, of course, you know, they do mesh, and they do, you know, particularly the character Packard is sort of the link between.
Who is he?
That I can't tell you. It's in the book when the female character Nora first meets him, he presents himself as a policeman. By the time we get to know him a little better, you never see him doing police work.
That's right.
I can't tell you as we sit here, you know, exactly what he does all day or who he is, except I know he's somebody who had very kind of bad experience, violent bad experience in World War II. And when that happens to someone, that kind of a thing, I think it goes one of two ways. Either you generally either want to, you know, go in a room and hide and not come out. You're trying to protect yourself. Or a less common reaction to it is that everything seems too tame. And, you know, you go looking to up the ante. And I think that's what Packard did, obviously. So what he's doing, I mean, he's looking to up the ante, not just physically and put himself in dangerous situations, but he's trying to, you know, get some meat on the bone. He's trying to get some meat on his life. He's trying to find, you know, these things that other people talk about. He doesn't understand love, really. He's, you know, he wants to be able to feel in his teeth again, you know, living. And that's what he does.
You know, there's a motto that runs through the book. Characters remind each other that it's a hungry world. And all over the book there's evidence of that. People are either immensely fat or they are hungry in a different way in terms of lust or in terms of violence. But there's that sense that what generates action and inaction both is hunger. It seems to be the motive of this plot. Your hero, Train, seeing an ordinary carrot of groceries, just a bunch of carrots, yogurt, the usual stuff, thinks, I've never seen more food in one place since I left home. And, you know, it's sort of as if everyone's hunger is making this shake up. If they were sated, they might rest for a while.
I think, you know, that's a very... that's a good reading. I mean, when you said it, it occurs to me. I mean, I hadn't thought of it exactly in those terms. I mean, the guy that says it's a hungry world is this ex-fighter who is, you know, already had one torn retina. Is that what you call it? I can't.
Yeah, braided retina, torn retina, sure.
And you know, and then it doesn't sound right to me. Anyway, it's a common thing in boxing. And now has another one. And, you know, it's in fact going blind or is blind. And that's sort of his view, having been a black fighter for the last 10, 12 years in the, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and moving in those circles, you know, out of L.A. but into the fight towns across America and living in that place where sometimes you get fed and sometimes you get paid and sometimes you don't and sometimes they put you in a hotel that has heat and sometimes you don't. His idea is that it's a hungry world, and it's very literal that whatever you are, there's something else out there that wants to eat you. And so he's not talking as much about his own hunger as he is about, you know, the world itself wanting part of you. But well, that's an interesting reading. I mean, because I didn't put that together.
You see, it's my as I read these books, and I've read most of them. You know, I'm talking to Pete Dexter about his new book, Train. It's from Doubleday. But it's my belief that no one who's good at writing has any power except to unconsciously organize all kinds of things. It doesn't have to be on the surface. But I'm reading this book, and suddenly I've been noticing how many of the Dodd men are real fat. And before long, we get this comment about hunger. And then before long, still, there's one character named Sugar. He's a bad guy. There's another character named Sweet. He's a good guy. And I think the unconscious of this book is organizing everything around that being hungry situation, and that these leaner guys, the stay hungry kind of guys, are really the people who are seen to be alive. They're the people who don't want to necessarily be fed. They want to be full of appetite all the time, and that sexual hunger becomes the center of the book, that there's a guy who simply can't get enough of the woman at the heart of the book, and it's, you know, that strange constant appetite that generates some of the book's hilarity.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, to me it's interesting what you just said, too, if you don't... I mean, you know, the place a book actually, when the rubber hits the road, it's when you pick the book up and read it. And I've written it, or, you know, someone's read it and I haven't written it and I read it. It's, and at that spot, what you bring to it as a reader matters as much as what's been written in the book in a lot of ways. You know, when you say writers have no choice but to do these things, even, you know, subconsciously, well, mean, that's the mark of a good reader, really, too. I mean, because it's like, you know, you walk outside and there are a million things to see and you find the meaning in them.
Well, I thank you, but the thing that interests me is that, you know, I look at you. We've never met before, but you're a pretty wiry guy, you know. In certain ways, you've just come into the studio. You have a cot. Before long, people were getting you Band-Aids.
Of course. Yeah. It's a dangerous place. It's not a good neighborhood either.
Of course, I have never seen, you know, Tom Jones comes in and he sticks a needle in his arm because he's diabetic. You come
really?
In and, you know, the bruisers and the rough guys come in, they want to show that they bleed. That's the first thing that happens. And you don't have a choice about it. You know what I mean? Part of this is about reminding people, because after all, you're writing books. What do we think about books in America? Kind of sissified, huh? These writers want to remind you that there's another world out there, the world of the rough and tough, the world where complacency doesn't get its day in court. The book is meant to shake the reader up no matter what the reader wants. Do you know what I mean? And I have the feeling that that's what the characters who write books like that want, too.
Now, maybe it's a. I mean, I don't associate it with being book writing is sissified anymore. I mean, I think it was when I was younger, like, you know, when I was in school and stuff, but which was a long time, by the way. 8 years to get a BA from the University of South Dakota. You're not the best, you know. They didn't retire my number there. But I don't have that sense now as much as it's just being something really obscure that a few people do.
One of the things that happens to the woman in this book and trained by my guest Pete Dexter, I'm Mike Silverblatt and you're listening to Bookworm, Nora has been married to a rich guy. She seems to barely know his friends. His funeral, we barely even go there in the book. He's violently killed. They've never, one assumes, have known her very well either. And she's just waking up to a realm of possibilities that are, you know, wilder than the ones that she settled for. And if books, you know, teach you about life, what these books are going to teach their readers is not to settle for something that starts to become stagnant or boring or easy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I believe that. And I think it is worth pointing out that because in normal life, you know, I mean, life's becoming more dangerous now than it used to be, but it always has been there. And relation, you know, like loving somebody is inherently dangerous. I mean, you can't get that for free because it there's always a possibility you lose. You know, you lose one way or another, you lose them. And so, you know, if I were to try to put a message along those lines, I would say, yeah, that it's a dangerous place. I think the thing you have to do with that is just the safest thing is to settle into who you are and be that, you know. It's and live with it. I mean, you know it's dangerous, and then you go ahead and live like it's not.
Well, this may just be another one of my interpretations, Pete, but I think on the last page of the book, for instance, Nora, having decided that she loves this man, shoots him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of what this book is about, by the way, I think, is marriage. It's she just wants to get his attention. I mean, she doesn't kill him. She shoots him in the leg. But, yeah.
Well, she's immobilizing him.
Yeah. Yes, she is.
She's going to make sure that he can't hop away all that fast anymore.
That's absolutely so.
She wants him in her vicinity. She's taking a hostage to some extent.
She's taking the marriage into her own, into her control, in her own hands, where it's, you know, the thing that's been really bothering her for a long time with this Packard character is because she doesn't it isn't in her hands. And for the first time, I mean, she's not someone that's used to that. And I wouldn't exactly call it a test of wills, because Packard's constantly trying to do things, not constantly, but Packard does things to make her happy. He tries to accommodate himself to her, and it just doesn't work, because you know, when does that ever work? I mean, you have to kind of be yourself, and your wife is herself, and you can't change to yourself or herself. Is this making any sense?
It's making sense to me, because you know what I think about this stuff. I think, you see, here you've got a writer. What do people complain about writers? That they're alone all the time and that they're up there writing. The other side of that, of course, is the guy who won't stay at home, and no one likes him either. So here you've got a writer, Pete Dexter. In other words, someone who's got to stay to some extent around a desk or a computer, writing about a guy who won't stay put. And we've got this woman who's got to be a triangulation between the kind of women who are sick and tired of their writer husbands being home all the time and the woman who's married to the rascal, who's sick and tired of the man being away all the time. And that's what's going on in this book, the pull secretly between the invisible writer character offstage and this macho stuff that's going on the page.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, and it doesn't – I mean, that might be what's going on in my life too. I mean, my poor wife – my wife's probably sick of both ones. I would just go back for a second. I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, the lonely life of the writer and stuff, and that's – that to me has never held much water. I've because if you're lonely, call the dog or call a friend or go play golf or go, you know, do what you do or, you know, horse around with your wife or go to a movie. I mean, it's – you essentially – I mean, maybe somebody like Updike is – or these guys that work 8 and 10 hours a day have better attention spans than I do, or they twitch less. But to me, I can tell when it goes stale, and I start about 1 o'clock at 9 in the morning usually, and by 3 o'clock it's usually I've got 800 words, and it's if I use more than that, if I put more words than that down, I'm going to spend the first 15 minutes tomorrow night, you know, cutting them out anyway. So it's not like real work. It's not like being a forest ranger either. I mean, it's really while you're there, it can. You have to pay attention, and it's not the easiest thing in the world. But boy, it's nothing like the poor guy that's got to get up and and spend 10 hours doing a real job. So the lonely life thing, I think, works a lot better when to someone who hasn't experienced not being lonely. I mean, you know, in a big way, who has to go wait tables for 10 hours a day, go talk to her about or him about being lonely and how good that sounds.
When I'm reading a Pete Dexter book, I want to have a life as exciting as the lives in the book. You know, you're one of those people who will convince someone like me, who's a constant reader, that the better life is in the open air, you know? Moving quickly and fast and far. And you see, I keep thinking, nah, but that can't be. A writer's written this. This has required a certain amount of stick in one place. And I'm always fascinated by the pull that books like this give me between, you know, the comfortable life that makes it possible to write something and the active life that makes it possible to write something exciting.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be one or the other, though. I mean, I think even – first thing is I came to this from a kind of a different place. I was a newspaper columnist for a lot of years, and that, and particularly in Philadelphia, things were constantly happening. As an observer there at the particular paper I went to, sometimes as a participant, and – you know, I never tried to separate those things. They're just both part of the same thing I do. And now I live on an island, and, you know, I spend I was saying earlier today to someone else, I spend no time at all in waiting for, you know, there's two stoplights in the whole 30 miles south end of the island. There's a, you know, there's very little noise, but the days are, you know, it has its drama and it has its fun. And I'm, you know, I get up in the morning and I eat and I take care of myself a little bit, you know, do some exercises. And then, you know, I'm half the days I'm going, you know, taking the ferry over and seeing a movie, or I'm going out and playing golf, or I'm, or, you know, there's always things to fill the day. And sometimes those things might seem mundane to me, the way I, you know, if I were looking at them from being a 30-year-old newspaper columnist again, but it doesn't feel that way at all to me. Just the days just really seem full and eventful, and occasionally something still pops up that, you know, would have appealed me back in my wilder days.
Well, in Train, the characters say things like, it happens because that's what happens, you know. The day is the events in it. And if they're wild and woolly and horrible, well, that was that day. That's what happens. And there is that sense, as you're reading this book, that the characters are living a Shaggy Dog story.
Huh. Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, I guess I know what a Shaggy Dog story is.
Well, you know, I find myself, I guess the big thing that I get a kick out of is not believing in these people, is thinking that there's a writer there pulling my leg. That, you know, a new extremity. When we were in the car in Train and this wild man with strange teeth pops up and his girlfriend, and they've got all sorts of strange ideas and they're going to be put out by the narrative before you know it, and both characters are laughing hysterically at having, you know, these people haven't wanted to scare our characters. Our characters have scared them back. By the end, they're laughing hilariously, but I can't help it. I think it's a writer's laughter. I think it's the laughter of someone who pulled a funny trick and just brought some weird bozos out of the jack-in-the-box, and now I've just done the scene. They're not going to be in the book anymore. I can throw them to any wind that comes along, and I don't have to account for them any more than this. I just had a lot of fun. And that's that thrill ride.
Yeah, that part's true. But I would say that that something a lot like that particular episode happened to me. I mean, it doesn't come from – but, yeah, it's meant as landscape in a funny way. It's like – you know, I'm not where, you know, someone else might have taken, you know, those 15 pages or however long it lasts to describe the Pacific Highway, or, you know, shown you something that you haven't, you know, tried to paint this sort of a landscape for you. To me, that is the landscape. That's the thing that moves the juices.
But as I was reading this, Train, by the newest novel by my guest Pete Dexter, I found myself thinking all the time about how, yeah, this writing, for all of its wild, uproarious, sudden, vicious quality, it wants to remind people that, yeah, we're in the jungle, that it's kind of tooth and claw, but it also isn't. Sometimes tooth and claw is a daydream of a bored person. You know, I wish it would get some more exciting around here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all this mixture of wish fulfillment and actuality. And that's what I guess I felt as I've read all these books, the feeling of knowing this wild guy who couldn't possibly be as wild as these books are, but who wants to give us the idea that such a thing is possible. That's what a writer gets to do, have imaginative seances in which the worst things imaginable happen, even while on the island in the middle of the river that's been made possible by the writing of the books.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but I think it's also true that these kind of things do happen. I mean, I think it's all real. And it can be as, they don't, it's not as sudden or as unpredictable as the books are. I mean, you can put yourself in places where things, more things will happen and you'll see more things. But those kind of, the episodes that we're talking about, you sort of pick between, all these years of watching and being part of things, and at the end of it, what I'm choosing to put on the page is the things that seem to provoke the most change, the most when I was I did some magazine work a long time ago, and I'd always try to follow somebody until something happened. If it took a week or 2 weeks or something, the thing that happens, if it's, it doesn't have to be violent but something upsetting or good the other way, but the difference between the way someone presents himself to you and wants to have you think of himself and the way that person becomes when something real happens, when as Norm MacLean said, I guess it was Norm MacLean. When you hit the third rail, when you see that change tells you more about the person than really the week you spent following them around and having them on their best behavior.
And so the writing, the novels, is getting them onto the third rail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you do other things. It's not constant, but... That's one of the ways that people really reveal themselves. You see amazing things in those situations.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Pete Dexter about his newest novel, Train, published by Doubleday. Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
I've wanted to meet you for a long time. You can read the first chapter of Train on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book, off the mouse, pop, time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.